This week on the podcast, I have Professor Robert Frank. He teaches economics and management at the graduate school up in Cornell and is the author of a number of books. He's probably best known for the winner-take-all society, a very prescient book published in 1995, way ahead of a lot of the more recent commentary on changes in society. Most recently, he's published Success and Luck, Good Fortune and the Myth of Meritocracy. It's a fascinating conversation about how we all tend to underemphasize and just not realize the impact that random fortune has in our life for both better and worse. He also wrote a textbook with some guy named Ben Bernanke on economics. Really, I think you'll find this to be a fascinating conversation if you're at all interested in how, not the politics, but the economics of income inequality and how these things have developed and what their subsequent impact is on both efficiency and productivity of the economy and what it means for society, for the middle class, for changes in corporate structures. I think you'll find this to be an absolutely fascinating conversation. So with no further ado, my conversation with Robert Frank.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
My special guest this week is Professor Robert H. Frank. He is a professor of management and economics at Cornell's Johnson School of Management. That's the graduate school up at Cornell. He has won numerous teaching awards and all sorts of other accolades. Comes to us with a BS in mathematics from Georgia Tech, has a master's in statistics and a PhD in economics from Berkeley, and is the author of a number of books, several of which we'll talk about later today. Most recently, Success and Luck, Good Fortune and the Myth of Meritocracy. I would be remiss if I didn't mention the textbook he co-wrote with some gentleman named Ben Bernanke, Principles of Economics, and he probably is best known for a book published in 95, The Winner-Take-All Society, that won all sorts of Critics' Choice Award, Notable Book of the Year by the New York Times, Business Week's Top 10 list for 1995. Robert Frank, welcome to Bloomberg.
Barry, what a pleasure.
So that was the short version of your CV. I could have gone on. If I started discussing the published papers, we would be here till next Tuesday. But one of the things that really struck me about your background is how long you've been studying income inequality. How did you first get interested in that subject?
Yeah, it's become quite fashionable now.
But it has.
When I first started writing about it, it was very difficult to find anybody who cared.
Mm-hmm.
I think my own interest in it was kindled by my interest in biology, where if you know an animal's rank in whatever group it's
alpha,
in,
beta, what have you.
Right. That's the most powerful predictor of that animal's ability to project its stuff into the next round.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's a famine, it's not the high-ranking animals that starve. The high-ranking animals typically have much better mating opportunities. There's a whole variety of reasons for that. But if you don't care about where you rank, you're probably not coming into the world very well equipped to deal with the competitive fray that we're in.
And it is quite a competitive world, especially when it comes to economics.
On the other hand, to really succeed in today's world, it's essential to be a trusted member of an effective team. You have to be able to be seen by others as trustworthy and cooperative. Really effective teams with talented people, have their pick. They don't need to hire any jerks for their team.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not a person they feel they can rely on when you're out of view and you have a chance to serve your own interests at the expense of the team's, then why should they have you on their team? They've got better choices. So it's a kind of a complex balancing act. You have to be somebody who's attractive to others and trustworthy in situations where you could cheat them, but they have to feel confident you won't. But you have to also care about getting ahead.
So it's a little bit of a balance in society versus what we see out in the wild.
Exactly. Society has done an enormous amount to try to tame the competition. We have all sorts of regulations that prevent arms races that get out of control in nature. But I think, you know, the income inequality problem is maybe one of the early signs that our attempts to keep things in balance have been falling short.
So let's talk about income inequality a little bit. I want to mention, it's funny that you said how fashionable it is today. I'm going to pull a quote from either your book or it was a paper that you had written around the same time the book had come out that I thought was fascinating. And this is from 1995. Quote, "The incomes of the top 1% have more than doubled in real after inflation terms between 1979 and 1989, a period during which the median income was roughly flat and which the bottom quintile, the bottom 20% of earners, saw their incomes actually fall by 10%. Now, that sounds like something that could have come out a year or two ago about the prior decade. And yet, this was not a big issue back in 1995.
I think we were just starting to see clear evidence of those trends that were beginning. They began sometime in the late 60s or early 70s. There's still some quarreling about when the exact moment was. There probably wasn't an exact moment. But as it's gone on longer and as the multiples have gotten bigger, more and more people have taken interest. And, you know, there's been a lot of very serious work in recent decades on it.
Well, you were writing Piketty-type stuff 20 years before Piketty was writing them.
Yeah, well, it's not always who gets there first, who wins the prize. Yeah, Piketty's gotten a lot of very well-justified attention on these issues. And he's done the rest of us who are in the trenches writing about this subject an enormous service. You know, we can now write a piece on the issue and people will pay attention to it, whereas it would have gone lost in the shuffle 20 years ago.
That's a really interesting point. I find, first, it's amazing how similar the data sounds 20 years ago to today. That's astonishing. But was income inequality all that obvious back then to people who were looking at it? Was the boom in technology, remember, 90s, a huge boom in technology, the stock market was on fire. Were we just otherwise occupied and not paying attention? How did this slip by relatively unnoticed right in the middle of the 90s?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and I don't have a compelling answer for it. If you take the early onset of the date range, the late 60s, as the time when income inequality started growing rapidly, then 1995 is plenty of time for a lot of people to have noticed it, and many people did notice it. It's just that the subject hadn't really caught on as one of general interest.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Professor Robert Frank. He teaches up at Cornell, both economics and management. Let's talk a little bit about The Winner-Take-All Society, the book you co-authored in 95 that seems to be quite prescient about a variety of changes that have taken place in our economy. Let me start out with a quote. What do Boris Becker, Alan Dershowitz, Diane Sawyer, Michael Jordan, L. McPherson, and John Griffin all have in common? They are beneficiaries of the winner-take-all markets. Now, what's interesting is how memorable all those names are, and still, unless you're a millennial, you probably know who all those names are because there was a lot of longevity to it. Explain to us what the winner-take-all society is.
There's a kind of market. We've seen this market structure going back a long, long time, actually. It was written about in the 19th century in similar terms to the ones we use to describe it. It's a market where if you have a task that can be done market-wide by a single person, then essentially you've got the conditions for a big tournament. It's a valuable task, typically, if somebody can serve the whole market. And if there are thousands of people trying to be anointed the person who gets to do that, then the competition's pretty bitter, and there's a lot of bunching of talent and effort. All the people who are finalists in that contest are going to be really, really good. But typically, one will emerge, and it will be someone who's maybe a little bit better than most of the others, but rarely the best contestant. He's also had a lucky break or two along the way. Mm-hmm. But when the winner emerges, there's a huge difference between the reward that person gets and the rewards received by others who were really so close to being as good that no one could really tell. It was almost an arbitrary choice to anoint the winner. And so you get a situation where, you know, most people feel comfortable if somebody works 1% harder than others or is 1% more talented. Well, fine, let him be paid 1% more. But here you have some buddy emerge who's 1% more talented, and that person might earn 10,000 times as much as the others, who are almost as equal.
So let's use Michael Jordan as an example. Wins 6 NBA Finals, which was a huge run, but at the same time has this amazing set of endorsement deals. He makes hundreds of millions, literally hundreds of millions more than he's paid as an athlete to do all his endorsements and other business ventures. And at the time, nobody else is even close to him.
Yeah, there would be plenty of people who would do his job for a tiny fraction of mm-hmm. what he gets. You would, I'm guessing. I would have been willing, but
you have more height than me, so you could do that.
Well, height's not all you need. You watch the highlight reel of Michael Jordan, and you think you're seeing something in slow motion because it really does seem that he's hanging in midair right. for 35 seconds
before. And making decisions on the fly that are not only instantaneous, but three steps ahead of everybody else, and then executing on those decisions
right.
while hanging in midair.
So maybe he's not the best example of a winner who's only a little bit better than the others. Maybe
give us another example.
Like Secretariat, he won by 30 lengths. But typically, it's not that far ahead of the field when we see a winner emerge. It could have been any one of a number of people who emerged that mm-hmm. way. And
well, you mentioned Alan Dershowitz or Elle Macpherson or John Grisham. There are a lot of fantastic novelists who sell millions of books. Is that and their books become movies? Is John Grisham a winner-take-all example?
He's definitely an example of someone who's been a really big winner in a winner-take-all market.
So not only have the books done well, but a dozen of his books have become really big movies.
And the surest way to publish a bestseller is to have already published one. If you've published two, then you're even more likely to have a bestseller. And then once you've got a string of them, the movie people start bidding against one another for the rights. Yeah, the rewards really do explode once you're on a successful track. But if you would go back early in a person's career, it wouldn't be so clear that would be the person who would emerge and become the big winner. Even in Michael Jordan's case, he was cut from the basketball team
right.
at a couple of stages.
High school, right, know. Didn't do well. What about J.K. Rowling? I think her book was turned down a dozen different publishing shops.
And she just on a lark published a detective novel or a whodunit under a pseudonym mm-hmm. after she'd quit the Harry Potter series. Mm-hmm. And the book got good reviews, but sold tepidly. Then
until it was revealed.
It was leaked that the author really was J.K. Rowling.
That's air quotes around leaked.
It shot to the top of the bestseller list. So, yeah, having been successful is the biggest thing that can assure your success in the next round.
So what impact does this star system have on society, and what does it mean for the long-term economic efficiency of how things run?
Well, it's got good aspects to it and also some ones that ought to concern us. So if you think of piano manufacture, in the last century, it was a local industry. Why? Because it costs so much to ship pianos that mm-hmm. if you tried to sell one too far from the factory, the shipping costs would eat you alive. And then canals opened up, railroads, the market expanded enormously that could be served by a single producer. So the good thing for consumers, if there really were some producers who were better than others, now they could extend their reach. So you'd be buying a better piano than you would have had access to before. The downside of that is that it tends to lead to an enormous increase in the concentration of income. The people who were thriving in local markets before, now they compete to see who's going to be the one who dominates the broader market that's now serviceable by these firms since transportation costs are low. And the losers in that contest, they've got to go find something else to do, basically.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Professor Robert Frank of Cornell, and we were discussing earlier how the middle class has begun to fall behind going back as far as the 1960s or 70s. You put out a book called Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. And again, some of the data points in this are just astonishing. I want to reference the Toil Index from a paper you put out in 2011. Listen to this data. This is astonishing. Between 1970 and 2000, the median earner would have gone from working a little more than 40 hours a week in order to be able to afford the median priced home to working close to 70 hours a week, almost double. How did that happen?
Yeah, it was the monthly number of hours you had to work in order to earn enough money to gain access to the median price house. And that's an interesting number because if you're in the middle,
you would earn the middle, right?
You would want to send your kids to a school of at least average quality. And to do that, you have to buy the median price house because, as is true in every country, school quality tracks house prices in the neighborhoods very closely. So, So every parent wants to do that. Houses have gotten bigger during that time. That's partly why families have to work more hours to be able to afford access to the median house. And it's just that others like them are spending a higher percentage of their income too. So you've got to match what they do or else you fall behind and it's your kids who go to schools with the metal detectors out front.
What has the addition of a second breadwinner in a household done to this data?
So that's a really interesting question. In the 50s, we had one earner families. Now it's much more common to have two earners. So families should be doing much better. Well, they don't seem to be doing much better. And one reason is that a lot of the extra money has gone into a bidding war for houses in the better school districts. So we've got more money now. What's the first thing we want to do? Send our kids to better schools. Well, other families want to do that too. And it's as if everybody stands up to see better. Nobody sees any better than before. We just bid up the prices of the houses in the better school districts. Half of all kids go to bottom half schools, the same as before.
There's no way around that math, is there?
That's the cruel dilemma that inequality confronts people with.
That Lake Wobegon exists just in fiction, and
exactly.
All of the children are not above average.
It can't be.
Cannot be. So let me throw another data point out that I thought was fascinating from Falling Behind. The share of total income going to the top 1% of earners was 8.9% in 1976. By 2007, it had risen to 23.5%, just about tripling. During the same period, the average inflation-adjusted hourly wage declined by more than 7%. So last time we looked at this data in 95, the top 1% were growing, the bottom 20% were falling, and the median was flat. Here we see the top 1% growing much more in this time period, and the average is actually falling. So what's the drivers of this?
You know, I think it's the same technological changes that Phil Cook and I talked about, and that indeed Alfred Marshall had talked about in the 1890s. As technology lets the most able performers in each domain extend their reach, there's just going to be a bigger slice of the market that they can effectively serve, and then the bidding for their services heats up. We don't need more than two or three sopranos at this point. 100 years ago, the only way to listen to music was live
in person,
concert.
Yeah.
But now we listen to music mostly in recorded form. Once the master discs have been stamped out, they can make copies, MP3s, other media are essentially zero cost to copy. And so the real trick is to find the performer who's better, at least in the public's eye, by a small margin. People want that performer and no other.
So this leads to a really interesting question. You have the current impact of technology and globalization and automation and more of the winner-take-all society. Pre-19th century, it was almost a feudal system where you had the one local monarch and everybody worked for them. That almost leads me to think that the post-World War II middle class was an aberration.
That's a theme in Thomas Piketty's book, that the period of post-war relative equality was the aberration, not the norm. I think the assumption all along had been, well, that's normal and we're moving away from it. I don't think that issue is completely settled, but the technological forces that are causing incomes to concentrate at the top, those haven't even begun to finish playing out. You know, Amazon is going to continue displacing retailers until there almost aren't any more retailers, and we're a long way from that happening.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Professor Robert Frank. He is the author of Success and Luck, Good Fortune and the Myth of Meritocracy, as well as The Winner-Take-All Society and Principles of Economics, a textbook co-written with some guy named Ben Bernanke. Let's jump right into success and luck, because this is a topic that I find absolutely fascinating. Part of the reason is, in this series, in these interviews that I do, you would be amazed at how many billionaires say, and of course I got lucky early in my career, or this happened and it was just good fortune. And I know a lot of people think that that's just a false humility, but I think and have observed that folks really, especially people who are wildly successful, I don't mean, hey, good job, good career, whatever. I mean wildly successful, winner-take-all, top of their field, billionaires. Many of them reference the role of luck in their success. Why is that?
I think that's a great thing when you see it happen, and you do see it happen. I've known successful people who are very quick to acknowledge that they had breaks and wouldn't be where they are now except for them. But still, there are many whose position seems to be, I did it all on my own. Think back to 2012 when Elizabeth Warren gave her "You Didn't Build That" speech. It was a video that went viral. It had millions of angry comments directed at her. What did she say? She said, "You built a business, it succeeded, that's great, but just remember, you shipped your goods to market on roads, the rest of us helped build, you hired workers the community paid to educate, police and firemen that we hired helped protect you. Part of the social contract is to pay forward so the next group that comes along will enjoy those same opportunities to succeed that you did." I don't hear anything controversial in those remarks, but people were very angered by them. And so if you tell a rich person who's beginning with the posture, I did it all myself, that, hey, you were lucky also, which is almost always true, they tend to hear you saying that, oh, you don't belong where you were. You're
not skillful.
Yeah.
You're...
That's not the message. No, the people who win in these markets are almost invariably really skillful, and they work really hard. So it's in a way natural that when they try to explain to themselves why did they succeed, that they focus on their hard work and talent. That's a big factor in what did bring them to the top. But they were also very lucky.
So let's take an example from the book that I thought was pretty fascinating. How lucky of a guy was Bill Gates?
Oh, Bill Gates, to his everlasting credit, is really quick to acknowledge how lucky he was. He had one of the few schools that had a computer lab in it. He was born in 1955.
Didn't exist where...
If he'd been born 10 years earlier, that wouldn't have existed. If he'd been 10 years later being born, people would have been all over that already. He was there at the right time. He got access to the computer labs at the University of Washington.
Like an actual lab with real-time response, not the punch cards that
not
the
where
rest
you
of
carry
us had
your
to deal
deck
with.
Up the yeah. hill and wait 3 days to see what happened.
Right.
He was
in high school. That's an amazing thing.
He had and he'll say there's probably what wasn't a group of a dozen worldwide who had opportunities like he had. But then, even so, you would never know who he was, probably, if IBM hadn't sort of, in a short-sighted move, given him the license to sell the operating system to its personal computer that it was about to launch. They didn't have high hopes for sales of that machine. And so he ended up being the richest man on the planet, as he's quick to concede, because he got a few really well-timed breaks.
The technology lore is he goes out and purchases a version of DOS for $50,000 from a company who the urban legend is that founder eventually commits suicide years later when he figures out what he does, sells this to IBM, and IBM never says, yeah, we're going to buy this from you. Instead, they'll say, yeah, we'll pay you for each one. We'll pay you less, but every time we sell a machine,
right.
we'll give you a royalty. And that was an amazing...
But make no mistake, Gates is really smart. He's very talented. Very hardworking, but that combination of things isn't sufficient.
So the guys who come in second, the men and women who come in second, they're really smart, they're really hardworking, they're really creative and skillful and opportunistic, but some of them just don't get a lucky break, and they don't achieve the sort of success that we see from the smart, hardworking, lucky ones.
Bryan Cranston, I had never heard of. Mm-hmm. I watched Breaking Bad. He was unbelievably good in it. When Vince Gilligan proposed casting him in the Walter White role, mm-hmm. which was the heart of that series,
sure.
The studio bosses said, no way, this is a guy who's never had a leading dramatic role. He's a middle-aged sitcom guy.
He was the goofy dad
in Malcolm in the Middle. Which I had never seen, but who saw it said, well, he was good.
If you saw it, you would have never in a million years imagined him as Walter White.
Exactly.
He was a goofball, funny, but certainly not that intense, dramatic persona.
So the studio people, they said, no, we're going to offer the part to John Cusack.
Totally wrong person for that.
Cusack turned it down. All right, Matthew Broderick. Matthew Broderick turned it down.
Even more wrong for the role.
Only then did they go to Cranston. Now, of course, Cranston is a superstar. Everybody wants him in their picture. And he was in his mid-50s. He was not going to become a superstar if either Cusack or Broderick had taken that role. That was going to be a fate for him, just like thousands of other actors. They're good enough to succeed, but they don't get their chance.
So I've noticed, you've written about this, other people have written about this, the issue of luck versus skill seems to divide along the political spectrum. Some people on the left are faster, liberals are more quick to attribute luck to people's success, conservatives have a tendency to attribute skill. To me, it's luck and success, so what is the basis of this divide?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. And John Haidt, my friend John Haidt, the psychologist, has done some interesting work. There are temperamental differences between liberals and conservatives. Actually, the split between the two groups on the role of luck is maybe a little more nuanced than our popular impressions mm-hmm. make it seem. But, you know, conservatives are less likely to believe in the challenges to the concept of free will than liberals are. And so there are some similarities in belief patterns across the groups. But I think if you probe a little more deeply, people from all along the political aisle, if they really think about the examples that they know about, are quick to concede that, yeah, it helps to be lucky. Being good and working hard by themselves aren't usually enough.
So we were speaking earlier about Michael Maubuisson, who is at Credit Suisse and a professor at Columbia, who wrote The Success Equation, which looks at skill and luck in business, sports, and investing. And I said, hey, I'm going to be speaking to Robert Frank. Any questions for him? And he said, yes, absolutely. He gave me a few, but let me give you one or two of my favorites. How do we justify CEO pay based on skill? Or are there other processes that better explain the current ratio between CEOs and workers?
That ratio, as you know, has exploded. It used to be something like 20 times as mm-hmm. much as the average worker pay
for the CEO.
In 1980, the CEO ratio to
that average. Recently, 1980, was 20
Business
to 1.
Business Week has tracked the CEO pay to average worker ratio since then, and it's up, depending on how large the corporation, it's up around 400.
Wow.
And has gone higher than that. It's a huge increase. It's the ratio itself has exploded by a factor of 10. And there's a lot of argument about why people talk about crony boards mm-hmm. that are voting favors for their pals who installed them on the board. You know, that happened when I was a boy. We used to hear about interlocking directorates and
pals. But you didn't get 400 to 1 ratios.
You didn't. And I think there are clear examples of waste, fraud, and abuse still. But the world really is a lot more like the NBA now than it was when I was a kid.
Meaning?
It's all
a lot of three-point shots?
It's all competition. What have you done for me lately? If you're not performing up to the highest standard, if there's somebody we could replace you with who would be even epsilon better, you're out the door. And I think that's, you know, you don't know who's going to be a good CEO up front. You take your chances, but the data are pretty clear. If you hire a CEO and the performance doesn't follow, then they're on a very short leash now compared to the old days. So,
but they're on a short leash with a very nice parachute.
They get a very high salary. If they don't perform, they're out. They land whole because they get the nice parachute. But think about it. If you're right about the CEO, and the CEO really is, let's say, 3%, 5%. If you're a $10 billion company annual earnings, you know, that's $300 million difference mm-hmm. on your bottom line. So having somebody who's just a little bit better in this kind of market really does translate into a huge difference in the bottom line.
If people want to find your work other than Amazon, where else can they find your writings?
I have been for more than a decade a contributor to the Economic View column in the New York Times. Mm-hmm. I'm doing it less frequently now, but occasionally I still write one. Mainly I'm writing books these days. So I'd go to the Amazon page and search out what's available. On Twitter, I'm at EconNaturalist.
Easy to find you via Google. Be sure and check out my daily column on BloombergView.com or follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. Welcome back to the podcast. I don't know why I do this every week, but I do. Bob, thank you so much for doing this. I was really looking forward to chatting you, and you have not disappointed.
It's been great fun to get a chance to talk with you.
So before we get to some questions that I skipped over during the broadcast portion, before I forget, so you write an economics, the Economics View column for the Times. That's a monthly, typically in the Sunday business section. Is that right?
Yeah, it depends on how many people are in the rotation, which has varied anywhere from 5 to 10. But it's come out.
But at the same time, there is a Robert Frank who writes for the Times. He's a reporter, and he's the author of the book Richistan: A Journey Through the American Wealth Boom. How confusing is it to have two Robert Franks, both publishing in the Times, about wealth and economic inequality?
Even before he started writing for the Times, we were being confused for one another again and again. In fact, the Times published an article about how often people mistook one for the other back in 2007, I think it was. And
that's funny.
Probably the best story in connection with people mistaking us for each other is an email I got from a friend in Houston. He had seen an announcement for a conference catering to high net worth individuals. And there was in the brochure for the conference a picture of me.
With him.
No, a picture just of me. I was going to be talking about high net worth strategies or this and that. That's not something he thought I would be likely to be doing. So he wrote back and asked me, and I said, wow, you know, if I'm speaking at that conference, this is the first I've heard about it. So I made some inquiries, and it turned out that they had tried to book the other Robert Frank. They called the Speakers Bureau, who represents me, and booked me instead mistake. The Speakers Bureau requires a hefty, non-refundable fee up front, deposit, and the Speakers Bureau refused to refund the fee to the client, even after it became clear that they hadn't meant to engage me. They said, "Well, he's willing to talk to you. We're prepared to send him." So I got a fat check for doing nothing that time.
That's great. Well, you did go and speak, right?
I did not.
You did not. They just gave you.
I did nothing.
Now that sounds like an economic inefficiency, to say the least. I want to get to a couple more questions that we skipped earlier, some of which I find really, really intriguing on success and luck. So, again, another Michael Mauboussin question. We tend to attribute our success to skill and our failures to bad luck. How do we get people to be more aware of the true role of serendipity in their lives, as opposed to merely thinking when it goes my way, it was all me, but if something goes wrong, it's just bad
fortune. You could steer people to the studies that show that there's that asymmetry. I suspect few people would want to read them. Mm-hmm. And there's actually a kind of a perverse adaptive quality to the asymmetry. So, for example, if you believe that when you succeed, it's because of your skill, not your luck, then the next opportunity that comes along, you'll say to yourself, well, skill is a persistent trait. I had skill before I succeeded. There's no reason not to explore this opportunity. So that's good. You're more likely to take the action that would lead to success.
Yeah, but isn't that how we end up with a Michael Jordan playing baseball?
Yeah, well, there's never a strategy that works well all the time. You know, but with the bad luck side of that, if you attribute your failures to bad luck, then you'll try something, you'll fail at it. Oh, I was unlucky. Then another opportunity comes along, and bad luck is not a persistent trait. Mm-hmm. You'll say, oh, I was just unlucky last time. I'm going to try this time. There's no reason to think I'll fail again. So the person who has that asymmetric view about good luck and bad luck may actually do better over time than the person who's more realistic in his beliefs.
It's funny. It's long been the case on Wall Street trading desks that they recruited athletes. And a number of people have pondered this. And my best explanation for that is you can work hard all week. You can run the drills, memorize the playbooks. And on a Saturday, you get a bad bounce or an unlucky call. You have to get up on Monday and brush yourself off and start all over, which pretty much describes what happens in the random walk on Wall Street. You have to be able to say that just was a bad bounce and start all over. It's a little bit of hindsight bias. It seems to fit the existing facts and it sort of rationalizes it. But I have yet to find a better explanation than that asymmetrical way to shake off the bad news and take credit for the good news.
One of the themes in the book is that false beliefs sometimes are adaptive for you. So when you're thinking about, is luck important in your life? Let me read Duncan Watts's blurb that he's a very distinguished sociologist. If your listeners don't know him, run out and buy his book, Everything is Obvious, Once You Know the Answer. It's a terrific, terrific, informative book. He writes, building a successful life requires a deep conviction that you are the author of your own destiny. That's absolutely right, by the way. I think if you think, oh, I'm a cork in the river, woe is me, that's you're not going to attack your life in a very effective way. He continues, building a successful society requires an equally deep conviction that no one's destiny is their own to write. Balancing these seemingly contradictory ideas may be the most important social challenge of our time. And then he goes on to say nice things about the book.
That's a fascinating way to look at it from bottoms up and top down.
Exactly.
What works for an individual may not work for a society.
Yeah. What we should believe if we want to be effective psychologically confronting the world may not be a very accurate description of how the world works.
So if inequality, as an example, is a natural outcome of, and again, I'm going to quote Maubassant, a path-dependent outcome, luck.
Exactly.
What, if anything, should we do about that?
One of the points I try to make in the book is that we haven't been investing for the future. The kids who are growing up today without a lot of money in their families are having a hard time getting through school. They're handicapped from a very early age in terms of the training they get. It would cost money to do something about that, but the point I try to make in the book is that those of us who have done well could easily supply the resources we need to do something about that without making any sacrifices that would be painful at all.
And the idea, for instance,
I had a conversation with a colleague. He was afraid about the new taxes that were coming. I said, look, don't worry about them. People like us, it doesn't matter. He has a successful textbook. He's not going to spend everything he earns.
Right.
You know, I don't spend everything I earn. We have everything we need, right? What's at issue? Will we still be able to get what we want if taxes go up? Said, yeah, that's what he was worried about. Well, what do people like us want? We've got everything we need. We want something special. You want to be able to have a special celebration when your daughter gets married. You want to have a house with a sweeping view of the lake, a choice slip at the marina, whatever it might be. There aren't enough of those things. You have to bid against other people like us to get them. What happens if their taxes go up and our taxes go up? Who gets those things? The same people as before. So,
and he bought this.
You know, I'm not going to say he bought it, but he seemed willing to think about it. But if someone were willing to think about it, it's uncontroversial. You know, the things that we care about are defined very heavily in relative terms. Everybody wants to have a special occasion for his daughter's wedding. What's special? It's a purely relative concept. People today are spending $30,000 on weddings on average. In New York, it's $76,000.
Not around here, then.
$76,000 in Manhattan. Why? And it was $10,000 back in 1980. Why have they gone up so much? Because other people are spending more. And why is that? Because people at the top are spending more, and it trickles down. But they're not bad people. They just want to have a special occasion, and special is relative. If you spend way less than everybody else spends, then it seems like a kind of a two-bit wedding.
You use the example that lovers in poor countries, when dating, they give a single rose as a gift, and it's well-received. But in wealthy countries, if it's not a dozen roses, it's thought of as you're being cheap, and it's not the same sort of resonance.
Yeah, it's a familiar point. No one hears about examples like that and say, oh, that's not the way the world is. Everybody knows that's the way the world works. So it's interesting that people resist the notion that framing effects and context matters as much as it does.
So let's take another example, something I enjoyed from the book, where we were talking about how relative things are and how when the same tide goes up or down, it affects everybody equally. And use an example of, we have big tax cuts, which affords somebody to drive a Ferrari, but it's over these beat up, potholed, cracked roads. Had we not had such large tax cuts, if the tax cuts were a little smaller, society can afford to pave everything and have nice, smooth asphalt. And at that point, you're driving a Porsche on a smooth, clean road, which overall is the better experience for the individual and what's the better experience for society. And the conclusion is the Porsche on the smooth, well-paved roads is better for everybody than a Ferrari on a horrible pothole road where you can't get out of second gear.
You know, Barry, I have yet to meet anyone who says, oh, no, that's not right. I'd rather drive a Ferrari on roads riddled with foot-deep potholes. Nobody says that.
Well, the pushback would be it's not just the Ferrari, but it's all this across the whole board, and it's confiscatory, and we can't have high tax rates, and it's a whole philosophical digression.
Right.
But I'm talking at a marginal change sufficient to, I don't know, pay for the infrastructure we all use. And I'm a car fan. I like anything that goes fast. And I've been complaining about the roads for a long time. We've had a gas tax that's been frozen in place since 1993. Which leads to a question. Something else came up in one of your columns, which had to do with the anti-government philosophies that say we can never raise taxes, we shouldn't be spending money, government should be as small as possible, and that's how we end up painted into a gas tax that's unchanged for almost 25 years.
Yeah, it's just not in the interests of anyone to have that rigid anti-tax position.
And yet that's become almost the default for half of the politicians.
You hear people say without any self-consciousness that taxation is theft. And the presumption there seems to be, I earned it, it should be mine to keep. Well, every country in the world has mandatory taxation. What's the position here?
Somalia. Somalia is your exception.
Taxes should be voluntary like they are in Somalia. Do you want to move there? Nobody seems to be queuing up to move there.
Right.
So if you don't have mandatory taxes, then you don't have a government, you don't have an army, you get invaded by some other country that has an army, then you pay mandatory taxes to them. So the interesting questions are, what should we tax? How much should we tax it? All those things are ripe for discussion, but we don't seem to have any ability to discuss something that has the word tax in it.
I have a sneaking feeling that this coming election, that might be a big issue. And the fallout after this election might see some interesting rethinks of pre-existing thought processes. We'll have to see how that plays out.
We'll watch that with great interest, won't we?
So back to the Ferrari. You had a column in the Times when I was researching this, I found and thought was pretty interesting, which said, conspicuous consumption is not so crazy.
You know, we're creatures of our inheritance. Is it cold out? Well, if you ask somebody that in Miami, where I grew up, on a 60-degree day in November,
they're not happy.
They know it's cold out. It's a stupid question. But if you ask somebody in, I don't know, Helsinki on a 60-degree day in March, they'll think you're stupid for asking. But the answer's the opposite.
It's
course
delightful.
It's not cold out. So, yeah, context shapes our evaluations. You know, I lived in a two-room house with no plumbing or electricity the 2 years I was a Peace Corps volunteer in rural Nepal. Not for 1 minute did that house seem in any way unsatisfactory, but neither you nor I could live in that house here in the U.S. without feeling ashamed of our circumstances. Your kids wouldn't want their friends to know where you lived. So context is clearly important as a frame for making evaluations. How am I doing? You can't answer the question without a frame of reference. How am I doing relative to what? You know, relative to people like me here and now. How am I doing?
And what is it about some of these luxury purchases that are either signaling events or, you know, the difference, again, to go back to the Porsche and the Ferrari, the difference between the Porsche and the Ferrari, it at a certain point it becomes harder and harder to justify each $100,000 increment for the next next tenth of a second.
Yeah, once you're up to the Porsche 911, that's a $150,000 car, you've got virtually every design feature that affects performance in any significant way. So if the Ferrari Berlinetta is a better car, some people will argue that it isn't, but if it is, it's at most just a hair's breadth better. And so you're not getting much in absolute terms, but if you were on a planet where the Porsche were the best car and we could hook in the driver's brains, how happy are they about their car, they'd be just as happy as the drivers on the other world where the Ferrari were the best car. And so, you know, it's the subjective sense that you're driving something special that people are really willing to pay for. You know, if your car would get to 60 miles an hour in 1920, it would seem fast to you.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, if it got that fast. Now it's got to get there. Now the Tesla gets there in 3.2 seconds.
Right. In a ludicrous mode. It's now in fact, the Tesla is faster than the Porsche and the Ferrari,
yeah,
which
so
is a huge change.
Yeah, so the standards are very elastic that define special.
And so this is subjective it's relative, and the context makes a great deal of difference.
Yeah, and collectively, we have some say over what the context is. You know,
meaning?
It's not in our interest to keep throwing tax cuts into pockets that will result in spending that just bids up the context. Why would an executive be happier in a world where everyone had a 50,000 square foot mansion in that circle than in a world where the mansions were only 40,000 square
feet? And you use the example in one of the books that if you ask people which would they prefer, if everybody has a 2,000 square foot house and yours is 3,000, or if everybody has a 6,000 square foot and your house is 5,000, and people take the bigger small house rather than the smaller big house.
Yeah, if the small house gets small enough, they'll flip.
Right.
But yeah, within a reasonable range, I think people judge correctly that they're probably going to be happier about their house if it's not a relatively inferior one in their local context.
That's interesting. Last of the Maubassant questions. So most people understand luck at a very high level. How are we capable of pinpointing the role of luck in very successful outcomes? Is there a way to identify, other than Bill Gates saying, hey, I was really lucky, I went to this high school, I got this, IBM made this bad deal, which we took advantage of. Unless someone's admitting that, how could we really identify luck versus skill?
You know, it's interesting how you get people to think about the role of luck in their lives. And there was an article on Mother Jones by Kevin Drum last week. He had seen a piece that was excerpted from my book on Vox, vox.com. And he was quick to identify all the lucky things that had benefited him in his life. But he was skeptical about my claim that telling rich people they'd been lucky would make them more willing to pay taxes. The claim in the book is that if you're more cognizant of having been lucky, then you are more generous toward the next generation. And I wrote him back and I said, well, I agree. Just telling them that they're lucky will elicit a reaction of anger and defensiveness, much as the you didn't build that speech did.
Right.
You're telling people, oh, you don't belong where you are. But there's an interesting twist. If you'll ask a successful person, can you think of any examples of breaks you've enjoyed along the way? That completely disarms the anger and the defensiveness. People seem to immediately light up. They think about what their past. If they think of an example of a break they had, they want to tell you about it right away. The more examples they can think of, the happier they seem to get. It's just a complete jujitsu maneuver. It has a dramatically different effect on how they react to the idea that luck may have mattered in their lives. And so I wrote that up into a piece with the title I like best of any piece I ever wrote. The title is Ask, comma, Don't Tell.
ask people
about their
that's
lucky
great.
Experiences.
Don't ask, tell. That's a variation on a Ben Franklin issue. Is instead of debating with people, he would agree with them and ask them as to, my position is wrong and I can't figure out, and he would elicit their help, and by the time they were done, they had convinced him that his position was right. But there's a certain fact to having people volunteer it themselves rather than, the Socratic method has been around for a few thousand years, not for no reason. So let me jump to some of my favorite questions. I was going to ask you about your background, but pretty much out of the PhD, you taught math, and then you ended up at Cornell 20 years ago or so. How long have you been there for?
I've been at Cornell since 1972. I came right out of graduate school and started my teaching career at Cornell, and I've been there ever since, except for various sabbatic leaves and the like.
So who are some of your mentors? There's one I have to ask because I'm a fan of his work, but
I would say that the two economists who have shaped my thinking personally the most, by a wide margin even, one would be Tom Schelling, a Nobel laureate in 1986, a longtime Harvard Public Policy School professor. I think he, more than anyone, had written clearly about why what it makes sense for us individually to do may not make sense for us to do when we think about it from the perspective of the groups we belong to.
Mm-hmm.
So all standing to get a better view.
Right.
No one sees better than if everybody remained comfortably seated. That's kind of a trivial example of that sort. But that's been a big theme in my own thinking about behavior and social organization. The other economist who's had the most influence on me is Ronald Coase,
mm-hmm.
who
also Harvard?
No, he was University of Chicago.
Okay.
He was also a Nobel laureate and wrote very little, actually, just a handful of articles. But one, I think, is the most widely quoted and cited article of all time in economics, The Problem of Social Cost. And it's a way of thinking more clearly about what happens when somebody does something that has either negative or positive spillover effects on others. You make noise, it disturbs the neighbors, you drive a heavy car, you put others at greater risk of injury and death. It used to be that people thought about those kinds of issues in terms of perpetrators and victims. You know, there mm-hmm. were good guys and bad guys. And his insight was that, no, these are people whose interests, both legitimate, are just in conflict with one another. And mm-hmm. their shared interest is to figure out the most efficient way of resolving their conflict. And that sometimes leads to very counterintuitive conclusions about what ought to be done.
So let me ask you about two other people who were at Cornell. One is someone you reference in the book, Ed Gramlich, was on the Federal Reserve Board.
Yeah, he was a member of the Board of Governors of the Fed.
Very insightful, way ahead of the curve, criticizing subprime lending, predatory lending, and a whole slew of different things that he brought to Alan Greenspan's attention. And Greenspan said, don't worry, the marketplace will take care of it. And actually, Greenspan was right. Eventually, the marketplace did take care of it.
After we went through the ringer.
Right, just not quite the way I think he anticipated. But you tell a wonderful story in the book about Gramlich and you on a ski lift.
Yeah, he came as a visitor my fourth year when I was at Cornell. I'd written very little. I had various issues had sort of kept me from putting as much time and energy into my writing. So I was, you know, today they would fire somebody like me in year mm-hmm. three. Then they kept me on just because I was a good teacher in a big class that was hard to staff. But they would have fired me at next opportunity, I'm quite sure. But Ned took an interest in my work. We became friends. He offered to publish a paper if I would write it for a volume he was editing. And nobody else had shown any interest in what I was doing up until then. So I happily agreed and wrote the paper. I was pretty pleased about it. I gave it to him. And then a day or two later, he came to my office with a hangdog expression saying that the sponsor of the volume that the paper was to have appeared in had called him to say the volume had been canceled. And it seemed like bad luck to me. I sent the paper out to a very selective journal just on Lark, and it got accepted for publication, which was, for me, a way better outcome
than, a little bit of luck
than if it had gone into an edited volume, which hardly anyone reads and, you know, isn't really a good career move. But yeah, I was incredibly lucky to get that paper accepted and I had a string of papers that got accepted in quick succession with almost no delay. That's never happened to me since then. The later papers I've written, I'm sure, were at least as good as those early ones. But if I'd had the usual editorial delays even with them, I would have been fired the next opportunity.
So the lucky break that the edited journal is canceled, what was it, Econometrica that...
So Econometrica accepted my paper.
Did that success beget the other subsequent?
Well, then there was a quick extension of the Econometrica paper that I thought to write. I sent it out. It got accepted quickly. I wrote three more papers the next summer. I sent them out for review. They got accepted in quick succession by three of the top journals in economics. That never happens. You know, all my other papers since then have gotten rejected at least once, many of them four times.
Right.
And when they accept it, it's after a year's delay or three rounds of revisions. So
if he didn't ask you to do this paper, you wouldn't have written it. If it wasn't canceled, you wouldn't have submitted it. And if none of these sort of random things didn't occur, that really ended up getting you tenure at Cornell.
Yeah, which was so far and away a better outcome for me professionally than mm-hmm. what would have happened, which I also know a little bit about. I would have had a very different life.
Quite fascinating.
Except for that string of quite fortunate events.
So the other person outside of Gramlich is a person who wrote a book that started me down a path into behavioral economics, which is Tom Gilgovich, who wrote How We Know It Isn't So, which I found, I don't even remember how I found it. Maybe a friend gave it to me way back when. And it's not a layperson book. It's really a little more detailed academic book. But it makes clear that the way we perceive our own cognition is wildly wrong.
Right.
And that we're really just a series of errors waiting to happen. And you I believe in, I don't remember which book it was, you referenced some of.
Yeah, Tom Gilovich is, in fact, a very close friend. We've been collaborators for decades. He saved my life once.
Oh, really?
There was a...
Literally?
Literally, yeah. No, he and I play tennis regularly.
Oh, you mentioned this in the book.
We were playing tennis one Saturday morning. In the second set, we were seated on the bench during a changeover. He tells me this. I don't have any recollection of it. He says, the next thing he knows, I'm lying motionless on the court, no breath, no pulse. He kneels to investigate, realizes this looks not quite right, and he yells out for somebody to call 911, and then he flips me over onto my back and starts pounding on my chest. You know, you've seen that done
sure.
many times in movies, so have I, so had he. He'd never been trained to do it. But
just started pounding on your chest.
He said one of his Israeli graduate students who'd been in the military had told him once that if you don't break the victim's breastbone, you weren't trying hard enough.
Right.
So he
and did he?
He no, he didn't break my breastbone. I don't think they never told me if he did. But he got a cough out of me after what seemed like forever. But then I went dead again, and he was about to give up hope when in through the doors of the tennis facility comes an EMT team. They cut my shirt off. They put the paddles on me. They rushed me to the hospital. They put me on a helicopter and fly me to a bigger hospital in Pennsylvania. They put me on ice overnight. 3 days later, I'm beginning to come out of the fog, and I'm told by the medical people in Pennsylvania that I suffered sudden cardiac death.
Just like that? Not a heart attack?
I died on the tennis court. 98% of the people who don't get immediate attention
die.
Never revive. Right. The 2%, they told me, the 2% who do make it, you don't want to see them.
Oh, really?
They're all kind of messed up, typically.
Long-standing.
If you're without oxygen.
To the brain, that's
causes
permanent damage.
Lots of problems for you. And for some reason, I escaped all that. And the reason had to have been that the ambulance came as quickly as it did. But that was the mystery. How did an ambulance come so fast when we were 6 miles out of town and the ambulances are dispatched way from the other side of Ithaca? And what I learned was that there had been two auto accidents close to the tennis center that had occurred before I collapsed. Two ambulances are well on their way to those accidents. One of them, the injuries aren't serious, so when the call comes to that one, they say,
they're right there.
Divert to the tennis center, we got something more important for you, and they were there. And except for that, I'm a dead man.
So not a coincidence you write a book on the role
yeah,
of luck in life.
Write about what you know. That's what they tell authors. And I tell people I'm probably the luckiest person they know. Maybe that's not true, but I'm certainly one of the luckiest.
That's pretty fascinating. So let's talk about other books. What are some of your favorite books that perhaps you haven't written? You have not written.
Tom Schelling's book,
which
I didn't mention the title of, is Micro Motives and Macro Behavior.
All right.
Absolutely wonderful book, if you liked.
Macro Behavior. All right.
If you liked Tom Gilovich's book, it's sort of aimed at that same slice of the market for the intelligent, curious person. I mentioned Duncan Watts's book.
I think I actually have that at home.
That is a fabulous book. Mm-hmm. Is the Mona Lisa famous because it's a great painting? No, says Duncan. He says it's famous because it's famous.
It's famous because it was stolen. Prior to that, nobody knew what it was.
Nobody gave a damn about it until 1911. Then it was stolen from the Louvre.
Not a big picture, by the way. Everybody thinks it's giant.
It's no big deal when you see it. At least that was my reaction, and his too. And so he saw that there were two Leonardo canvases in the very next gallery. Nobody seemed to be crowding around to look at them, but there were 300 people elbowing one another aside to see the Mona Lisa. And so he did a little digging, and he found that until 1911, nobody cared about the Mona Lisa. Then it got stolen. Took 2 years for them to resolve the crime. They arrested the Italian custodian who stole it. Then again, the painting splashed across the newspapers all around the world, first time that had ever happened. And so now it's a symbol of Western culture.
Quite amazing.
Pure chance that it got to be that.
And what was the name of Duncan's book?
Everything is Obvious, and then there's an asterisk, and in parenthesis beneath, it's asterisk, Once You Know the Answer.
I'm going to have to take a look. I'm pretty sure that's sitting in my queue waiting to be read. So let me get to my last two favorite questions I ask all my guests. So a millennial or a recent college grad comes up to you and says, I'm interested in a career in economics. What sort of advice do you give them?
I tell people to try to think of a time when they felt completely immersed in some activity, that the hours went by without them being conscious of time flying by at all. And to try and find a career where you would be doing that activity much of the time. If you can find something that you can engage with at that level, you will become an expert at it because you'll care so much about it. It won't seem like you're working hard to become an expert. It'll just be an organic process. And if you want to be a success, I think developing deep expertise at something is the route to take in today's climate. We were talking about winner-take-all markets. You know, being the third best person at something isn't going to do much for you. If you're the best at something, though, even if it's something that not that many people care about, there's often a lucrative niche for you. At the very least, you're going to be doing something you like.
There's a number of studies that talk about having an expertise, having a sense of control, and actually being able to affect the outcome that leads to worker satisfaction. Yeah. And so you're giving that exact advice to millennials.
Exact advice. You know, Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett's second in command, said that if you want to get what you want, a good strategy is to try to deserve what you want.
Makes sense.
And getting really good at something, that's how you most likely to get what you want.
My final question, what do you know today about skill and luck, about income inequality, about economics that you wish you understood better in the beginning of your career 20 plus years ago?
You know, most people, as I say in the book, tend to overlook the role of luck in their lives. That hasn't been true of me, not so much because I think I'm more observant or perspicacious than the typical person. I think luck has had a much more obvious effect in my life. I would not advise anybody to organize his life the way I've done. You know, I think I've stumbled into a career that's been, in so many ways, just the right career for myself. I think if you're more systematic about it, and today I probably wouldn't have succeeded. I think the doors start closing at younger ages now. Mm-hmm. You have to be have credentials all in line even to get into a good school now. It wasn't so much true when I was. But I think, you know, finding something that you like and you can get lost in would be the same advice I'd give to somebody almost at any age. So if you're a parent and you've got kids, You know, kids don't like everything that they do, and their reactions to the various activities that you urge them to try are instructive. So pay attention. Do they love something? You know, open some doors and see if you can get them more deeply involved in that thing that they love.
Thanks, Bob. This has been absolutely fascinating, and thank you for being so generous with your time.
Thank you, Barry. It was just an absolute pleasure for me to get to come down.
If you've enjoyed this conversation, be sure and look Up an Inch or Down an Inch on Apple iTunes, and you can see the other 90 or so such chats that we've had. I would be remiss if I omitted Taylor Riggs for helping to organize each of these conversations, and Charlie Vollmer, who is our chief engineer here. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.